Now, we began last time, it was a fortnight ago, to look at a study in Jonathan, the son of Saul, who was a prince of Israel, obviously a royal prince, and the one who, under normal circumstances, might have been expected to inherit the crown, to inherit the kingship. Obviously, in the Lord's providence, that was not going to be. But we do see many fine qualities in Jonathan. We began to see these in last time in chapter 13 here, and we see something of them again here in chapter 14. Chapter 14 is a very long chapter. We're just going to deal with the first part of it tonight. And we see again here Jonathan putting himself forward to, if you like, take the initiative against the Lord's enemies, against the invading Philistines, those who are inhabiting the land. We saw in chapter 13 at verse 3, he smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba. And Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear. And all Israel heard say that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel also was having abomination with the Philistines. So some, we might say, critical scholars might say that, oh, what you've got in chapter 14 is just the sort of telling of the story of what's told in chapter 13, because it's really just a reference to that verse 3 there where Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines. Because we read at verse 14 of chapter 14, that first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men. If that's the first slaughter, then what is this reference to the previous garrison here? It must be the same account. No, it's not the same account. And one reason we can say it's not the same account, because in response to the first smiting of the garrison in chapter 13, the Philistines then gathered themselves together to fight with Israel. They came in vast numbers, in verse 5 onwards, 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. You might say this is overreaction. You might see it as disproportion. But the purpose of such a massive invasion from the Philistine lands is to squash out this first flame of resistance before it can properly begin. And it has the desired effect, as we saw in chapter 13. Because when they gathered themselves together, when the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were distressed, the people did hide themselves in caves and in thickets and in rocks and in high places and in pits. And some of the Hebrews went over Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. As for Saul, he was yet in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. And we read at verse 15 in chapter 13 there that when Saul numbered the people, there are about 600 of them. Now, at the beginning of chapter 13, he'd got 3,000. So he's only got a fifth, 20% of what he had before. And he himself has gathered in Gibeah, sort of entrenching himself in what was no doubt a stronghold. And the Philistines are all gathered round about. They're sending out their spoiler companies to just sort of ransack and loot the land, as we see from verse 17. And we have reference to these spoilers here in chapter 14. Because when the Lord causes the land to tremble, that it causes all the different companies of the Philistines, and the trembling was in the host in the field, verse 15, among all the people, the garrison and the spoilers, they also trembled and the earth quaked, so it was a very great trembling. There's also reference in chapter 14 to those who had hidden themselves away. The Philistines in this garrison say, oh look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes of the rock where they hid. It is clearly an event subsequent to the first smiting of the original garrison. But again, it is Jonathan who is taking the initiative here. We might think, well, why doesn't Saul take the initiative? Why isn't Saul the one doing the attacking here? Why does it have to be Jonathan? And why does he have to do it without his father's knowledge or permission? The implication would suggest that Saul, perhaps conscious of his kingship and conscious of all that there is to lose, and perhaps considering that maybe Jonathan's rash behavior in the first instance brought this mass invasion of the Philistines, now Saul is certainly acting with caution, perhaps overmuch caution. There is a standoff, if you can call it that, between the massive army of the Philistines, which are plundering whatever they want, right, left, and centre, south and west and east and so on. And you've got Saul with his terrified 600 men gathering in Gibeah. And so far, the one, they're just sort of looking at the other from a distance. No doubt a battle would follow in due course, but the numbers are so completely disproportionate. 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand as the seashore on the Philistine side. And what have the Hebrews got? 600 men. 600 men, and also most of them don't have any weapons. We saw that at the end of chapter 13 there. So it's not exactly an even contest. So this will be one reason, perhaps, why Jonathan, with the Lord's courage being given to him, is not content simply to sit on his hands and wait for the inevitable battle between a vastly outnumbered and underarmed Israelite host against the huge numbers of Philistines. It's going to be a slaughter. It's going to be a complete and total wipeout of the Israelites. He can't afford just to sit and wait and hope for the best. He can't afford to be cautious. There's nothing to be gained now by caution. The only little victory they had because he took the initiative and smote the garrison of the Philistines. So what we see here at the beginning of chapter 14, you could say that it's almost a kind of suicidal kind, well, what have we got to lose? There is that element to it. But there is also a sense in which Jonathan, with the courage that the Lord gives him, would rather die free than live as a slave. He is not going to be overrun by the heathen Philistines. He is determined that at least they're going to fight in order to be free. And so he takes the initiative, but he told not his father. You can see there's a certain wisdom in this as well. If he'd asked permission and his father had said no, well, then he'd be disobeying if he goes and does it. And if he tells his father, and his father says, okay, yes, you can go, then maybe Saul looks bad for the fact that he's not the one going. So there is a certain amount of wisdom in the fact that Jonathan allows discretion, perhaps, to enter in here. Let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side. But he told not his father. Saul tarried in the uttermost part of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree which is in Migron. And Migron is several miles from Gibeah as such. So it's when it says the uttermost part, it almost means sort of the furthest reach of the city of Gibeah's influence. He's at the sort of extremity of his own territory here. The people that were with him were about 600 men, and he's got the grandson of Eli here, the Phinehas' son, Ahir, the son of Ahitub, the son of Phinehas, the great-grandson of Eli, in other words, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. He's also got, as we find out a little later on, he's also got the Ark of the Covenant there with him, because we're told that the Ark was with the people in those days. Number now the people. While Saul talked with the priest, the Ark of the God was at that time with the children of Israel, almost certainly for safety. 600 men may not be a huge protection against the vast numbers of the Philistines, but at least there is some protection. If they are raiding through all the country, there's nothing to stop them carting off the Ark of the Covenant again, just like they did years before, and the shame that fell on Israel when that happened. So they are keeping it in the midst of the army, but perhaps it is something of a superstitious talisman for Saul rather than a symbol of the faith of the living God. However, they attack the garrison of the Philistines, and they attack in this particular place where there's a sharp rock on the one side and a sharp rock on the other side. The name of the one was Bozez. Now, the name Bozez means shining, and the name of the other, Sene, which means the thorn. So obviously, one rock was particularly sharp and pointed in shape to depict a thorn. The other, perhaps because of the direction it was facing or the kind of minerals that might have been through the rock, obviously reflected the sun at particular times and was described as shining. So Bozez and Sene. And Jonathan said to the young man that bare his armour, come, and let us go up over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. In other words, we'll let them see us. We'll say, come on, here we are, come and fight with us. And if they say, right, okay, we're coming down, then at least they are vacating their outpost, their garrison position, and then the battle could be anyone's. But if they say, yeah, you come up to us, and we'll fight you here in our outpost, in our little redoubt here, and then we'll know, Jonathan says, that this is a sign from the Lord. Because, verse 6, there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. And the armor bearer, not particularly devout or religious perhaps, just says, well, do everything that's in your heart. I'll be going with you according to your heart. He's loyal, but he may not be the most devout perhaps. But Jonathan has the Lord in his heart. It may be that the Lord will work for us. There is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. If they say, come up unto us, then we will go up, for the Lord hath delivered them into our hand, and this shall be a sign unto us. And sure enough, that's what they say. And Jonathan said, come up after me, for the Lord hath delivered them into the hand of Israel. Notice how three times already in this opening part of the chapter, Jonathan is ascribing any potential victory to the Lord, the Lord, the Lord. Even Saul, when he sees the beginnings of a victory, simply says, you know, bring the ark and let's inquire. Number now, Jonathan, his armor bearer, were not here, not there. Bring hither the ark of God. And yes, okay, that's to consult with the Lord, but you see the sort of remove at which Saul's relationship with the Lord is. Now, he is the Lord's anointed, the Lord's choice, there's no question about that, but is his relationship with the Lord all that perhaps it should be? And so we have Jonathan with the Lord in his heart and ready to give the Lord the credit. Jonathan, who is a brave man, not saying that Saul isn't, but Jonathan is taking the initiative, taking the fight to the enemy, but recognizing he might die or he might win, but if he wins, it will only be because of the Lord. Come up after me, verse 12, for the Lord hath delivered them into the hand of Israel. And Jonathan climbed up upon his hands and his feet, and his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer slew after him. Now, it says that first slaughter was about 20 men within, as it were, a half acre of land. Jonathan's armor bearer, he's not carting his armor with him at the time. Obviously, Jonathan's wearing his armor at this point, but this is a sort of manservant, his body servant, the one who is particularly attached to him and his task and his profession and his duty. He's going to be there with him wherever he goes. He is his loyal lieutenant in that sense. So he follows wherever Jonathan goes. But remember what it says at the end of chapter 13. Saul and Jonathan, there were swords with them, but nobody else had. But with Saul and Jonathan, there were swords found, verse 22 of chapter 13, but nobody else had a weapon to speak of. If they wanted their pitchforks or their files, if they wanted them sharpened, they took them down to the Philistines, who sharpened them for them, and no doubt charged them for their agricultural implements being sharpened in this way. But they didn't have proper weapons, so when Jonathan attacks the Philistines, only he has got a sword in his hand. What is his armor bearer using? Perhaps, I don't know, a lump of wood, or a club, or something like that, we don't know. But from the first Philistine who dies, there's a weapon for the armor bearer to pick up. There's a spear, there's a sword, there's a shield, whatever. By the time 20 men have been killed, that's 20 swords, 20 spears, 20 shields they didn't have before. Even this little victory, if that was all there was, then Israel is already 10 times better off than it was in terms of its arsenal of weapons than it was at the outset. Even this little victory, the Lord gives. His armor bearer slew after him, and that first slaughter which Jonathan, his armor bearer, made was about 20 men within, as it were, a half acre of land which a yoke of oxen might plough. And then it says there was a trembling in the host. Now, the host is not directly attached to this little outpost. This would be a sort of sentry post. Yes, okay, a well-staffed miniature fort, probably. It'll garrison you. An outpost. It's not the main Philistine army. But when it says there was a trembling in the host, it's not because they all thought, ooh, look, one of our garrisons has been overwhelmed by two men. Oh, how terrible. We're all terrified. but rather because the Lord has worked this initial victory, then the Lord begins this supernatural trembling in the vast host of the Philistines. A trembling in the host, a mighty trembling. In the original Hebrew it says, a trembling of God. Such is the mighty power of the trembling. A very great trembling, it says at the end of verse 15. And a very great trembling, it's in the original, it's a trembling of God. Because he's the one that sends it. This is not, oh, suddenly there was an earthquake, so that made them afraid. Yes, there is a kind of quaking of the earth. But this is God causing the Philistines to become, for no apparent reason, terrified. Jonathan has overwhelmed an outpost, a little garrison of their sentries, and some of them are slaughtered that way, but this is what's really setting the fear amongst them. This, which they believe to be a work of the God of Israel. And the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah, his lookouts and so on, looked, and behold, the multitude, that is the multitude of the Philistines, melted away. It's not the Israelite multitude. They've already deserted in their droves. If you look back to chapter 13, and you see at verse 8, it says the people were scattered from Saul. They had deserted. They'd hidden in the rocks and in the caves. They'd crossed the Jordan for their own safety. They are gone. This is the Philistine multitude which Saul is seeing melting away. And they went on beating down one another. Now that doesn't necessarily mean they were fighting with each other. It means they were stampeding. It means they were treading on each other, trying to get away. A panic has begun. He doesn't initially know why. So he's beginning to get the ark of the Lord to inquire of. But then while he talked with the priest, verse 19, the noise that was in the host of the Philistines went on and increasing. It's louder and louder and louder. And it's, well, we don't need to ask more about this. We know what we have to do now. We have to capitalize on this. The people assembled themselves. They came to the battle. And behold, every man's sword, again, it must mean every Philistine's sword, was against his fellow. And there was a very great discomfiture. It cannot mean the Israelites, because if it's a victory, the Lord saved Israel that day, then you can't turn the swords of a mere 600 men against each other. This is the swords of the thousands of Philistines are being turned against each other. And now, if we were being cynical, we might say, oh, all the Hebrews that were with the Philistines that had been sort of turncoats and worked for them beforehand, suddenly thought, oh, well, they're losing. Now let's turn on them. Let's suddenly get brave. Turn to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, all the men of Israel which had hid themselves in Mount Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, even they also followed hard after them in the battle. And it is difficult, if not perhaps at the human level, impossible, not to have a certain sneer at such individuals and say, oh yes, you're very brave now. You're very brave now when the enemy's on the run. Where were you before? When Saul needed you, when they only had 600 men left and you were hiding in the caves and the holes in the rock. Where were you then? But now the Philistines are on the run. Oh, you're very brave now. You're all coming out in your droves. And whilst that might be a little uncharitable, it is not altogether untrue. However, we would also need to recognize what causes people to turn from cowardice to courage is not simply the knowledge of a potential victory. Because if you think back to the days of the judges, think back to Gideon, for example, where he was pursuing the Midianites. And I can't remember the exact number of the names of the cities. I think one of them was Penuel. He came to Penuel and he said, you know, well, give us bread and water because we're pursuing the Midianites. And obviously they were winning. If they were chasing them and they won a victory, then you would think, they would say, yeah, we'll come with you. No bother. But they said, well, you know, have you already won? Have you got their heads in your hands? Have you actually secured your victory? No, yeah, we give you bread and water today. The Midianites will come back and slaughter us tomorrow. So no, we're not doing a thing to help you. You fight it yourselves. And of course he said, right, well, when I come back in victory, I'll beat down the tower of your city. And to another city he said, when I come back, I'll torture you all with thorns and briars, which of course he did, because his men had been in need. But the two cities that he came to, just because they saw there seemed to be the scent of victory, they didn't get all brave suddenly. They didn't suddenly turn out in their droves and say, yes, we'll follow you with them. We'll chase them as well. We'll get some of the spoil. So it doesn't happen automatically. It is rather the Lord who is able to change the hearts of men, both individually and collectively. Whilst we might sneer a little and say, oh yeah, look at these cowards, they're very brave now, it is the Lord who changes their hearts. It is the Lord who causes them to think, yes, this is where we should be. We ought to have been on the side of the Israelites all along. Perhaps they're a little bit late in turning their allegiance back to where it should be. But there is no question that the fact of their having done so added to the complete rout of the Philistines that day. The change in heart from cowardice to courage amongst those who had previously fled and melted away and deserted, the fact that they came now pouring, as it were, out of the hills, out of the caves, out of every nook and cranny, when the Philistines had thought they were safe, suddenly everywhere they looked, here's an Israelite vengeful coming out of wherever he had hidden. It is this change of spirit which is as much a work of God's grace as is the quaking of the earth and the trembling in the heart of the Philistines. The fear that he puts in the one, the courage that he puts in the heart of the others, this is a work of God. It is a miracle of God's grace. And you will notice that just as Jonathan had previously given all the potential glory to God, he said, the Lord may deliver us out of their hands. The Lord may give us the victory. The Lord may fight for us, because there's no restraint to the Lord to save, whether by many or by few. So we read at verse 23. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed over unto Bethaven. In other words, they kept pursuing the enemy all the way. Bethaven is the same as Bethel. So they're heading off in a northeasterly direction, from northwesterly direction from where they were. It's not Jonathan that saved Israel that day. It is the Lord that saved Israel that day. It is the Lord who changed the hearts of the host, who put all the trembling in this massive host. It is the Lord who gave courage to the Israelite deserters. But notice the timing of when he does it. It would have been far more convenient, far more easy for Jonathan and for Saul if they just said, well, Lord, you know, a victory would be really nice. If you just make all the Philistines terrified and give all our boys courage, that would be great. And then you'll go up and we'll smite the garrison of the Philistines. But no, God doesn't do that. He doesn't do it that way around. When Jonathan and his armor bearer make themselves known to the Philistines, the Philistine host is still as brave can be. They're not trembling, they're not quaking, they're not running, stampeding in fear. They are still at their full strength. The Philistines are so cocky and sure that they will dispose of these two measly Hebrews. They say, come up to where we are. And they don't shoot arrows at them while they're trying to climb up. They don't try and cut their fingers off when they're grabbing onto the rocks. They want them to come up. They want them to come up so that they can have their sport with them, so that they can fight against them and slowly all attack them and put them to death and enjoy doing it. They want their fun. And they think they're going to get it. Come up and we will show you a thing or two. So they let them climb. They don't interfere with them while they're doing it. They let them arrive. And it's the worst thing they could possibly have done. Because it is God who gives the victory against them. It is God who slaughters that outpost of the Philistines. It is God who puts the fear and trembling into the Philistine host. But before he does it, Jonathan and his armor bearer have to act in faith and have to act in bare courage, because they declare themselves to the Philistines when there is still a whole army against them, when they have no promise of what the Philistines might do. They might have said, stay down there and we'll come down and we'll fight with you. And it was the other that was to be their sign from the Lord. They didn't know whether the Philistines would say, yes, we're coming down and we're going to slaughter you, or when they'd say, come on up, which would be the sign from the Lord that they were going to have the victory. They didn't know which it was going to be. They were prepared to hazard their lives. They were prepared to give their all in order for the possibility of a victory at God's hands. This is the kind of man, the kind of prince that Jonathan is. He is a man of faith. The Lord is in his lips. The Lord is in his heart. The Lord is his backbone and his strength. He is a man of faith. He is a man of trust. It's trust because he has to say, oh, well, but supposing we do, oh, God might let them smite us. Okay, if God lets them smite you, you die. If the Philistines overrun your camp, you're going to die anyway. If it comes to a battle between 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen and unnumbered amounts of infantry on the one hand and 600 Hebrews on the other side, well, you know how it's going to go. So you've got nothing to lose. You're going to lose your life today. You were going to lose it anyway tomorrow. So the Lord gives him courage. The Lord enables him to trust. He's a man of faith. He's a man of trust, a man of courage, and a man of daring. Now, he doesn't just, all of that is not just sort of a instantly in that generation. Clearly, his father Saul is a courageous warrior king as well, but he's not so great on the initiative. He's not so great on the faith and the trust, and his courage always seems to be tinged with caution. Jonathan is the one reaching out, if you like, taking the risk, stepping out in faith, taking the initiative, and putting that faith to the test. And if that should mean the loss of his life, well, so be it. And the armor bearer too, he's prepared to trust. Where Jonathan goes, he will go. If Jonathan trusts, if Jonathan has faith, that's good enough for him. And there is a sense in which such loyalty is likewise commendable. It is the Lord, however, who gives the victory. But for God to act, 9 times out of 10, he does not choose to act without means or without people. 9 times out of 10, the Lord chooses to act with an individual by means of instrumentality. He takes someone as his instrument, as his tool. In this case, it is Jonathan. Yes, he does a miraculous thing with the trembling in the host afterwards, but only after Jonathan has stepped out in faith. Only after that risk, that stepping out into the unknown, that courage has been taken in both hands. Now, if there is a lesson here for us in this day and age, then surely it is this. We are overrun by the forces of the world and the darkness and unbelief. Go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. It may be, it may be not. But that is our condition. We are overrun. Many have melted away from the Lord's cause. Many have hidden themselves. Many have crossed the Jordan and sought to flee. And they have lost their courage. They have lost their commitment to the Lord's cause, many. And there are some who remain faithful, but even those who remain faithful, remember we saw in chapter 13 and verse 7, all the people follow him, that is Saul, trembling. They also are afraid. And in this country, as we look around us, we might have reason to be afraid. Not only are the storm clouds gathering, they are well and truly gathered. The discrimination and attacks against the gospel and against the Lord's people are unremitting in the public sphere. Christians are treated in a way that those of other religions would never be. It is a difficult time to be a Christian. It is a difficult time to be part of what we might say the Lord's army in that sense, an army that seems to be ever shrinking. But here is Jonathan. Jonathan, who will not just sit and wait to be overrun, not just wait for the Philistines to overwhelm them, not just sit and say, well, as long as we stay here and they stay there, then we can have our little siege mentality, and at least it's a standoff. A standoff is not a victory. God doesn't just want a draw. He doesn't want the devil to make out that he's as good as God. He doesn't want a share of the spoils. He wants a complete, outright victory. And that is what he intends to have. And to do that, he raises up individuals now and then in particular generations, perhaps in every generation, particular individuals who will go forward in faith, who will take the risk and we will step out. And in doing so, the power of the Lord follows behind them. The power of the Lord, which gives them not only this victory over the garrison, but gives the victory over the whole host and changes around the hearts of those who were cowardly to give them courage again and to see, yes, the Lord can do anything. The Lord is in charge, and it follows like a flood, and it flows like a mighty river in spate. When the Lord brings times of revival or refreshing, what does the word revive mean? It means to bring alive again. And as somebody has pointed out, revival is not something that happens to the unbelieving world in general, because it's already sort of spiritually dead to begin with. But rather, reviving is a rekindling of the flame, a rebirthing of the strength of those who are meant to be God's people in the first place. And to do that, somebody must first ask. Somebody must first go forward. Somebody must first step out in faith. Such a man is Jonathan. He is doing it in a military capacity. But in his military capacity, he is acting likewise in faith, in trust, in courage, and in daring. And he is giving God the glory. Nobody at the end of this section, verse 23, is saying, wow, what a brilliant guy Jonathan is. Rather, what we are told is, the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed over unto Beth Aven. If we would see the Lord save his people in our day, then we too must ask, seek, knock, and be prepared to step out in faith and to risk all that we might gain